Chapter 12, 1756. Oswego. When, at the end of the last year, Shirley returned from his Bootus Oswego campaign, he called a council of war at New York and laid before it his scheme for the next summer's operations. It was a comprehensive one, to master Lake Ontario by an overpowering naval force and seize the French forts upon it, Niagara, Frontenac, and Toronto, attack Ticonderoga and Crown Point in the one hand, and Fort Duquesne on the other, and at the same time perplex and divide the enemy by an inroad down the Chaudière upon the settlements about Quebec. The council approved the scheme, but to execute it the provinces must raise at least 16,000 men. This they refused to do. Pennsylvania and Virginia would take no active part, and were content with defending themselves. The attack in Fort Duquesne was therefore abandoned, as was also the diversion towards Quebec. The New England colonies were discouraged by Johnson's failure to take Crown Point, doubtful of the military abilities of Shirley, and embarrassed by the debts of the last campaign. But when they learned that Parliament would grant a sum of money in partial compensation for their former sacrifices, they plunged into new debts without hesitation, and raised more men than the general had asked. Oh, with their usual jealousy, they provided that their soldiers should be employed for no other purpose than the attack in Ticonderoga and Crown Point. Shirley chose John Winslow to command them, and gave him a commission to that effect, while he, to clinch his authority, asked and obtained supplementary commissions from every government that gave men to the expedition. For the movement against the fort of Lake Ontario, which Shirley meant to command in person, he had the remains of his own and Pepperell's regiments, the two shattered battalions brought over by Braddock, the Jersey Blues, four provincial companies from North Carolina, and the four King's companies of New York. His first care was to recruit their ranks and raise them to their full complement, which, when effected, would bring them up to the insufficient strength of about 4,400 men. While he was struggling with contradictions and cross purposes, a withering blow fell upon him. He learned that he was superseded in the command. The cabal formed against him, with Delancey at its head, had won over Sir Charles Hardy, the new governor of New York, and had painted Shirley's conduct in such colors that the ministry removed him. It was essential for the campaign that a successor should be sent at once, to form plans on the spot and make preparations accordingly. The ministry were in no such haste. It was presently announced that Colonel Daniel Webb would be sent to America, followed by General James Abercrombie, who was to be followed in turn by the Earl of Loudoun, the destined commander-in-chief. Shirley was to resign his command to Webb, Webb to Abercrombie, and Abercrombie to Loudoun. It chanced that the two former arrived in June at about the same time, while the Earl came in July, and meanwhile it devolved in Shirley to make ready for them. Unable to divine what their plans would be, he prepared the campaign in accordance with his own. His star, so bright a 12-month before, was now miserably dimmed. In both his public and private life he was the butt of adversity. He had lost two promising sons, he had made a mortifying failure as a soldier, and triumphant enemies were rejoicing in his fall. It is to the credit of his firmness and his zeal in the cause that he set himself to his task with as much vigor, as if he, and not others, were to gather the fruits. His chief care was for his favorite enterprise in the direction of Lake Ontario. Making Albany his headquarters, he rebuilt the fort at the great carrying place destroyed in March by the French, sent troops to guard the perilous route to Oswego, and gathered provisions and stores at the posts along the way. Meanwhile, the New England men, strengthened by the levies of New York, were mustering at Albany for the attack of Crown Point. At the end of May, they moved a short distance up the Hudson, and encamped at a place called Half Moon, where the navigation was stopped by rapids. Here and at the posts above were gathered something more than 5,000 men, as raw and untrained as those led by Johnson in the summer before. The four New England colonies were much alike in their way of raising and equipping men, and the example of Massachusetts may serve for them all. The assembly or general court voted the required number, and chose a committee of war authorized to impress provisions, munitions, stores, clothing, tools, and other necessaries, for which fair prices were to be paid within 6 months. The governor issued a proclamation calling for volunteers. If the full number did not appear within the time named, the colonels of militia were ordered to muster their regiments, and immediately draft out of them men enough to meet the need. A bounty of $6 was offered this year to stimulate enlistment, and the pay of a private soldier was fixed at £1.6 a month, Massachusetts currency. If he brought a gun, he had an additional bounty of $2. A powder horn, bullet pouch, blanket, knapsack, and wooden bottle, or canteen, were supplied by the province, and if he brought no gun of his own, a musket was given him, for which, as for the other articles, he was to account at the end of the campaign. In the next year it was announced that the soldier should receive, besides his pay, a coat and soldier's hat. The coat was of course blue cloth, to which breeches of red or blue were afterwards added. Along with his rations, he was promised a gill of rum each day, a privilege of which he was extremely jealous, deeply resenting every abridgment of it. He was enlisted for the campaign, and could not be required to serve above a year at farthest. The complement of a regiment was 500, divided into companies of 50, and as the men and officers of each were drawn from the same neighborhood, they generally knew each other. The officers, though nominally appointed by the assembly, were for the most part the virtual choice of the soldiers themselves, from whom they were often indistinguishable in character and social standing. Hence discipline was weak. The pay or, as it was called, the wages of a colonel was £12.16, Massachusetts currency, a month, that of a captain, £5.08, an advance in the pay of the last year, and that of a chaplain, £6.08. Penalties were enacted against irreligion, immorality, drunkenness, debauchery, and profaneness. The ordinary punishments were the wooden horse, irons, or, in bad cases, flogging. Much difficulty arose from the different rules adopted by the various colonies for the regulation of their soldiers. Nor was this the only source of trouble. Besides its war committee, the assembly of each of the four New England colonies chose another committee for clothing, arming, paying, victualling, and transporting its troops. They were to go to the scene of operations, hire wagons, oxen, and horses, build boats and vessels, and charge themselves with the conveyance of all supplies belonging to their respective governments. They were to keep in correspondence with the Committee of War at home, to whom they were responsible, and the officer commanding the contingent of their colony was required to furnish them with guards and escorts. Thus four independent committees were engaged in the work of transportation at the same time, over the same roads, for the same object. Each colony chose to keep the control of its property in its own hands. The inconveniences were obvious. "I wish to God," wrote Lord Loudon to Winslow, you could persuade your people to go all one way. The committees themselves did not always find their task agreeable. One of their number, John Ashley, of Massachusetts, writes in dudgeon to Governor Phipps, "Sir, I am apt to think that things have been misrepresented to your honor, or else I am certain I should not suffer in my character, and be styled a damned rascal, and ought to be put in irons, etc., when I am certain I have exerted myself to the utmost of my ability to expedite the business assigned me by the General Court." At length, late in the autumn, Loudon persuaded the colonies to forego this troublesome sort of independence, and turn over their stores to the Commissary General, receipts being duly given. From Winslow's headquarters at Half Moon a road led along the banks of the Hudson to Stillwater, whence there was water carriage to Saratoga. Here stores were again placed in wagons and carried several miles to Upper Falls, thence by boat to Fort Edward, and thence, 14 miles across country, to Fort William Henry at Lake George, where the army was to embark for Ticonderoga. Each of the points of transit below Fort Edward was guarded by a stockade and 2 or more companies of provincials. They were much pestered by Indians, who now and then scalped a straggler, and escaped with their usual nimbleness. From time to time strong bands of Canadians and Indians approached by way of South Bay or Wood Creek, and threatened more serious mischief. It is surprising that some of the trains were not cut off, for the escorts were often reckless and disorderly to the last degree. Sometimes the invaders showed great audacity. Early in June Colonel Fitch at Albany scrawls a hasty note to Winslow, "Friday, 11 o'clock, sir, about half an hour since, a party of near 50 French and Indians had the impudence to come down to the river opposite to this city and captivate 2 men, and Winslow replies with equal quaintness, "We daily discover the Indians about us, but not yet have been so happy as to obtain any of them." Colonel Jonathan Bagley commanded at Fort William Henry, where gangs of men were busied under his eyes in building 3 sloops and making several hundred whaleboats to carry the army of Ticonderoga. The season was advancing fast, and Winslow urged him to listen on the work, to which the humorous Bagley answered, "Shall leave no stone unturned, every wheel shall go that rum and human flesh can move." A fortnight after he reports, "I must really confess I have almost wore the men out, poor dogs. Pray where are the committee, or what are they about?" He sent scouts to watch the enemy, with results not quite satisfactory. "There is a vast deal of news here, every party brings abundance, but all different." Again, a little later, "I constantly keep out small scouting parties to the eastward and westward of the lake, and make no discovery but the tracks of small parties who are plaguing us constantly, but what vexes me most, we can't catch one of the sons of. I have sent out skulking parties some distance from the sentries in the night, to lie still in the bushes to intercept them, but the flies are so plenty, our people can't bear them." Colonel David Wooster, at Fort Edward, was no more fortunate in his attempts to take satisfaction on his midnight visitors, and reports that he has not thus far been able to give those villains a dressing. The English, however, were fast learning the art of forest war, and the partisan chief, Captain Robert Rogers, began already to be famous. In the 17th of June he and his band lay hidden in the bushes within the outposts of Ticonderoga, and made a close survey of the fort and surrounding camps. His report was not cheering. Winslow's so-called army had not grown to nearly 7,000 men, and these, it was plain, were not too many to drive the French from their stronghold. While Winslow pursued his preparations, tried to settle disputes of rank among the colonels of the several colonies, and strove to bring order out of the little chaos of his command. Sir William Johnson was engaged in a work for which he was admirably fitted. This was the attaching of the Five Nations to the English interest. Along with his patent of baronetcy, which reached him about this time, he received, direct from the crown, the commission of colonel, agent, and sole superintendent of the Six Nations and other northern tribes. Henceforth he was independent of governors and generals, and responsible to the court alone. His task was a difficult one. The Five Nations would fain have remained neutral, and let the European rivals fight it out, but, in account of their local position, they could not. The exactions and lies of the Albany traders, the frauds of land speculators, the contradictory action of the different provincial governments, joined to English weakness and mismanagement in the last war, all conspired to alienate them and to aid the efforts of the French agents, who cajoled and threatened them by turns. But for Johnson these intrigues would have prevailed. He had held a series of councils with them at Fort Johnson during the winter, and not only drew from them a promise to stand by the English, but persuaded all the confederated tribes, except the Cayugas, to consent that the English should build forts near their chief towns, under the pretext of protecting them from the French. In June he went to Onondaga, well escorted, for the way was dangerous. This capital of the Confederacy was under a cloud. It had just lost one redhead, its chief sachem, and first of all it behooved the baronet to condole their affliction. The ceremony was long, with compliments, lugubrious speeches, wampum belts, the scalp of an enemy to replace the departed, and a final glass of rum for each of the assembled mourners. The conferences lasted a fortnight, and when Johnson took his leave, the tribe stood pledged to lift the hatchet for the English. When he returned to Fort Johnson a fever seized him, and he lay helpless for a time, then rose from his sickbed to meet another congregation of Indians. These were deputies of the Five Nations, with Mohegans from the Hudson, and Delawares and Shawnos from the Susquehanna, whom he had persuaded to visit him in hope that he might induce them to cease from murdering the border settlers. All their tribesmen were in arms against the English, but he prevailed at last, and they accepted the war belt at his hands. The Delawares complained that their old conquerors, the Five Nations, had forced them to wear the petticoat, that is, to be counted not as warriors but as women. Johnson, in presence of all the assembly, now took off the figurative garment, and pronounced them henceforth men. A grand war dance followed. 150 Mohawks, Oneidas, Onondagas, Delawares, Shawnos, and Mohegans stamped, hooped, and yelled all night. In spite of Piquet, the Tejoncares, and the rest of the French agents, Johnson had achieved a success. But would the Indians keep their word? It was more than doubtful. While some of them treated with him in the Mohawk, others treated with Doggerill at Montreal. A display of military vigor in the English side, crowned by some signal victory, would alone make their alliance sure. It was not the French only who thwarted the efforts of Johnson, for, while he strove to make friends of the Delawares and Shawnos, Governor Morris of Pennsylvania declared war against them, and Governor Belcher of New Jersey followed his example, though persuaded at last to hold his hand till the baronet had tried the virtue of pacific measures. What Shirley longed for was the collecting of a body of Five Nation warriors at Oswego to aid him in his cherished enterprise against Niagara and Frontenac. The warriors had promised him to come, but there was small hope that they would do so. Meanwhile he was at Albany pursuing his preparations, posting his scanty force in the forts newly built on the Mohawk and the Great Carrying Place, and sending forward stores and provisions. Having no troops to spare for escorts, he invented a plan which, like everything he did, was bitterly criticized. He took into pay 2,000 boatmen, gathered from all parts of the country, including many whalemen from the eastern coasts of New England, divided them into companies of 50, armed each with a gun and a hatchet, and placed them under the command of Lieutenant Colonel John Bradstreet. Thus organized, they would, he hoped, require no escort. Bradstreet was a New England officer who had been a captain in the last war, somewhat dogged and self-opinioned, but brave, energetic, and well-fitted for this kind of service. In May, Dougherty Hill sent Colin D. Villiers with 1,100 soldiers, Canadians, and Indians, to harass Oswego and cut its communications with Albany. Nevertheless, Bradstreet safely conducted a convoy of provisions and military stores to the garrison, and in the 3rd of July set out on his return with the empty boats. The party were pushing their way up the river in 3 divisions. The first of these, consisting of 100 boats and 300 men, with Bradstreet at their head, were about 9 miles from Oswego, when, at 3 in the afternoon, they received a heavy volley from the forest in the east bank. It was fired by a part of Villiers' command, consisting, by English accounts, of about 700 men. A considerable number of the boatmen were killed or disabled, and the others made for the shelter of the western shore. Some prisoners were taken in the confusion, and if the French had been content to stop here, they might fairly have claimed a kind of victory, but, eager to push their advantage, they tried to cross under cover of an island just above. Bradstreet saw the movement, and landed in the island with 6 or 8 followers, among whom was young Captain Schuyler, afterwards General Schuyler of the Revolution. Their fire kept the enemy in check till others joined them, to the number of about 20. These a second and a third time beat back the French, who now gave over the attempt, and made for another fort at some distance above. Bradstreet saw their intention, and collecting 250 men, was about to advance up the west bank to oppose them, when Dr. Kirkland, a surgeon, came to tell him that the 2nd Division of boats had come up, and that the men had landed. Bradstreet ordered them to stay where they were, and defend the lower crossing, then hasten forward, but when he reached the upper ford, the French had passed the river, and were ensconced in a pine swamp near the shore. Here he attacked them, and both parties fired at each other from behind trees for an hour, with little effect. Bradstreet at length encouraged his men to make a rush at the enemy, who were put to flight and driven into the river, where many were shot or drowned, as they tried to cross. Another party of the French had meanwhile passed by a ford still higher up to support their comrades, but the fight was over before they reached the spot, and they in their turn were set upon and driven back across the stream. Half an hour after, Captain Patton arrived from Onondaga with the grenadiers of Shirley's regiment, and late in the evening 200 men came from Oswego to reinforce the victors. In the morning Bradstreet prepared to follow the French to their camp, 12 miles distant, but was prevented by a heavy rain which lasted all day. In the Monday following, he and his men reached Albany, bringing to prisoners 80 French muskets, and many knapsacks picked up in the woods. He had lost between 60 and 70 killed, wounded, and taken. This affair was trumpeted through Canada as a victory of the French. Their notices of it are discordant, though very brief. One of them says that Villiers had 400 men. another gives him 500, and a third 800, against 1500 English, of whom they killed 800, or an Englishman apiece. A fourth writer boasts that 600 Frenchmen killed 900 English. A fifth contents himself with 400, but thinks that 40 more would have been slain if the Indians had not fired too soon. He says further that there were 300 bolts, and presently forgetting himself, adds that 500 were taken or destroyed. A sixth announces a great capture of stores and provisions, though all the bolts were empty. A seventh reports that the Canadians killed about 300, and would have killed more but for the bad quality of their tomahawks. An eighth, with rare modesty, puts the English loss at 50 or 60. That of Villiers is given in every proportion of killed or wounded, from 1 up to 10. Thus was Canada roused to martial ardor, and taught to look for future triumphs cheaply bought. The success of Bradstreet silenced for a time the enemies of Shirley. His cares, however, redoubled. He was anxious for Oswego, as the two prisoners declared that the French meant to attack it, instead of waiting to be attacked from it. Nor was the news from that quarter reassuring. The engineer, Mackler, wrote that the works were incapable of defense, and Colonel Mercer, the commandant, reported general discontent in the garrison. Captain John Vickers, an invalid officer of Shirley's regiment, arrived at Albany with yet more deplorable accounts. He had passed the winter at Oswego, where he declared the dearth of food to have been such that several councils of war had been held in the question of abandoning the place from sheer starvation. More than half his regiment died of hunger or disease, and, in his own words, had the poor fellows lived they must have eaten one another. Some of the men were lodged in barracks, though without beds, while many lay all winter in huts on the bare ground. Scurvy and dysentery made frightful havoc. In January, says Vickers, we were informed by the Indians that we were to be attacked. The garrison was then so weak that the strongest guard we proposed to mount was a subaltern and 20 men, but we were seldom able to mount more than 16 or 18, and half of those were obliged to have sticks in their hands to support them. The men were so weak that the sentries often fell down on their posts, and lay there till the relief came and lifted them up. His own company of 50 was reduced to 10. The other regiment of the garrison, Pepperell's, or the 51st, was quartered at Fort Ontario, in the other side of the river, and being better sheltered, suffered less. The account given by Vickers of the state of the defenses was scarcely more flattering. He reported that the principal fort had no cannon in the side most exposed to attack. Two pieces had been mounted in the trading house in the center, but as the concussion shook down the stones from the wall, whenever they were fired, they had since been removed. The second work, called Fort Ontario, he had not seen, since it was finished, having been too ill to cross the river. Of the third, called New Oswego, or Fort Rascal, he testifies thus, it never was finished, and there were no loopholes in the stockades, so that they could not fire out of the fort but by opening the gate and firing out of that. Through the spring and early summer Shirley was gathering recruits, often of the meanest quality, and sending them to Oswego to fill out the two emaciated regiments. The place must be defended at any cost. Its fall would ruin not only the enterprise against Niagara and Frontenac, but also that against Ticonderoga and Crown Point, since, having nothing more to fear on Lake Ontario, the French could unite their whole force in Lake Champlain, whether for defense or attack. Towards the end of June, Abercrombie and Webb arrived at Albany, bringing a reinforcement of 900 regulars, consisting of Otway's regiment, or a part of it, and a body of Highlanders. Shirley resigned his command, and Abercrombie requested him to go to New York, wait there till Lord Loudon arrived, and lay before him the state of affairs. Shirley waited till the 23rd of July, when the Earl at length appeared. He was a rough Scotch lord, hot and irascible, and the communications of his predecessor, made, no doubt, in a manner somewhat pompous and self-satisfied, did not please him. "I got from Major General Shirley," he says, "a few papers of very little use, only he insinuated to me that I would find everything prepared, and have nothing to do but to pull laurels, which I understand was his constant conversation before my arrival." Loudon sailed up the Hudson in no placid mood. In reaching Albany he abandoned the attempt against Niagara and Frontenac, and had resolved to turn his whole force against Ticonderoga, when he was met by an obstacle that both perplexed and angered him. By a royal order lately issued, all general and field officers with provincial commissions were to take rank only, as eldest captains when serving in conjunction with regular troops. Hence the whole provincial army, as Winslow observes, might be put under the command of any British major. The announcement of this regulation naturally caused great discontent. The New England officers held a meeting, and voted with one voice that in their belief its enforcement would break up the provincial army and prevent the raising of another. Loudon, hearing of this, desired Winslow to meet him at Albany for a conference in the subject. Thither Winslow went with some of his chief officers. The Earl asked them to dinner, and there was much talk, with no satisfactory result, whereupon, somewhat chafed, he required Winslow to answer in writing, yes or no, whether the provincial officers would obey the commander-in-chief and act in conjunction with the regulars. Thus forced to choose between acquiescence and flat mutiny, they declared their submission to his orders, at the same time asking, as a favor, that they might be allowed to act independently, to which Loudon gave for the present an unwilling assent. Shirley, who, in spite of his removal from command, had the good of the service deeply at heart, was much troubled at this affair, and wrote strong letters to Winslow in the interest of harmony. Loudon next proceeded to examine the state of the provincial forces, and sent Lieutenant Colonel Bergman, of the regulars, to observe and report upon it. Winslow by this time had made a forward movement, and was now at Lake George with nearly half his command, while the rest were at Fort Edward under Lyman, or in detachments at Saratoga and the other small posts below. Bergman found Winslow's men encamped with their right in what are now the grounds of Fort William Henry Hotel, and their left extending southward between the mountain in their front and the marsh in their rear. "There are here," he reports, "about 2,500 men, 500 of them sick, the greatest part of them what they call poorly, they bury from 5 to 8 daily, and officers in proportion, extremely indolent, and dirty to a degree." Then, in vernacular English, he describes the infectious condition of the fort, which was full of the sick. "Their camp," he proceeds, "is nastier than anything I could conceive. Their kitchens, graves, and places for slaughtering cattle all mixed through their encampment, a great waste of provisions, the men having just what they please, no great command kept up. Colonel Gridley governs the general, not in the least alert, only one advanced guard of a subaltern and 24 men. The cannon in stores in great confusion. Of the camp at Fort Edward he gives a better account. It is much cleaner than at Fort William Henry, but not sufficiently so to keep the men healthy. A much better command kept up here. General Lyman very ready to order out to work and to assist the engineers with any number of men they require, and keeps a succession of scouting parties out towards Wood Creek and South Bay. Quote, the prejudice of the regular officer may have colored the picture, but it is certain that the sanitary condition of the provincial camps was extremely bad. A grievous sickness among the troops, writes a Massachusetts surgeon at Fort Edward, we bury 5 or 6 a day. Not more than 2/3 of our army fit for duty. Long encampments are the bane of New England men. Like all raw recruits, they did not know how to take care of themselves, and their officers had not the experience, knowledge, or habit of command to enforce sanitary rules. The same evils were found among the Canadians when kept long in one place. Those in the camp of Villiers are reported at this time as nearly all sick. Another penman, very different from the military critic, was also on the spot, noting down every day what he saw and felt. This was John Graham, minister of Suffield, in Connecticut, and now chaplain of Lyman's regiment. His spirit, by nature far from buoyant, was depressed by bodily ailments, and still more by the extremely secular character of his present surroundings. It appears by his diary that he left home under great exercise of mind, and was detained at Albany for a time, being, as he says, taken with an ague fit and a quinsy, but at length he reached the camp at Fort Edward, where deep despondency fell upon him. Labor under great discouragements, says the diary, under date of July 28th, for find my business but mean in the esteem of many, and think there's not much for a chaplain to do. Again, Tuesday, August 17th, breakfasted this morning with the general. But a graceless meal, never a blessing asked, nor thanks given. At the evening sacrifice a more open scene of wickedness. The general and head officers, with some of the regular officers, in General Lyman's tent, within 4 rods of the place of public prayers. None came to prayers, but they fixed a table without the door of the tent, where a head colonel was posted to make punch in the sight of all, they within drinking, talking, and laughing during the whole of the service, to the disturbance and disaffection of most present. This was not only a bare neglect, but an open contempt, of the worship of God by the heads of this army. 'Twas but last Sabbath that General Lyman spent the time of divine service in the afternoon in his tent, drinking in company with Mr. Gordon, a regular officer. I have oft heard cursing and swearing in his presence by some provincial field officers, but never heard a reproof nor so much as a check to them come from his mouth, though he never uses such language himself. Lord, what is man? Truly, the May game of fortune. Lord, make me know my duty, and what I ought to do. That night his sleep was broken and his soul troubled by angry voices under his window, where one Colonel Glacier was berating, in an hallowed language, the captain of the guard, and here the chaplain's journal abruptly ends. A brother minister, bearing no likeness to the worthy Graham, appeared in the same spot some time after. This was Chaplain William Crawford, of Worcester, who, having neglected to bring money to the war, suffered much annoyance, aggravated by what he thought a want of due consideration for his person and office. His indignation finds vent in a letter to his townsman, Timothy Payne, member of the general court. No man can reasonably expect that I can with any propriety discharge the duty of a chaplain, when I have nothing either to eat or drink, nor any conveniency to write a line other than to sit down upon a stump and put a piece of paper upon my knee. As for Mr. Weld left square bracket another chaplain right square bracket, He is easy and silent, whatever treatment he meets with, and I suppose they thought to find me the same easy and ductile person, but may the wide yawning earth devour me first. The state of the camp is just such as one at home would guess it to be, nothing but a hurry and confusion of vice and wickedness, with a Stygian atmosphere to breathe in. The vice and wickedness of which he complains appear to have consisted in a frequent infraction of the standing order against cursing and swearing, as well as of that which required attendance on daily prayers, and enjoined the people to appear in a decent manner, clean and shaved, at the Tisungay sermons. At the beginning of August Winslow wrote to the committees of the several provinces, "It looks as if it won't be long before we are fit for the remove, that is, for an advance on Ticonderoga." In the 12th Loudon sent Webwick the 44th Regiment and some of Bradstreet's boatmen to reinforce Oswego. They had been ready for a month, but confusion and misunderstanding arising from the change of command had prevented their departure. Yet the utmost anxiety had prevailed for the safety of that important post, and in the 28th Surgeon Thomas Williams wrote, "Whether Oswego is, yet ours is uncertain. Would hope it is, as the reverse would be such a terrible shock, as the country never felt, and maybe a sad omen of what is coming upon poor sinful New England. Indeed we can't expect anything but to be severely chastened till we are humbled for our pride and haughtiness." Quote, his foreboding proved true. Webb had scarcely reached the great carrying place, when tidings of disaster fell upon him like a thunderbolt. The French had descended in force upon Oswego, taken it with all its garrison, and, as report ran, were advancing into the province, 6,000 strong. Wood Creek had just been cleared, with great labor, of the trees that choked it. Webb ordered others to be felled and thrown into the stream to stop the progress of the enemy. Then, with shameful precipitation, he burned the forts of the carrying place, and retreated down the Mohawk to German Flats. Loudon ordered Winslow to think no more of Ticonderoga, but to stay where he was and hold the French in check. All was astonishment and dismay at the sudden blow. Oswego has changed masters, and I think we may justly fear that the whole of our country will soon follow, unless a merciful God prevent, and awake a sinful people to repentance and reformation. Thus wrote Dr. Thomas Williams to his wife from the camp at Fort Edward. "Such a shocking affair has never found a place in English annals," wrote the surgeon's young relative, Colonel William Williams. "The loss is beyond account, but the dishonor done His Majesty's arms is infinitely greater. It remains to see how the catastrophe befell. Since Dodrill became chief of the colony he had nursed the plan of seizing Oswego, yet hesitated to attempt it. Montcalm declares that he confirmed the governor's wavering purpose, but Montcalm himself had hesitated. In July, however, there came exaggerated reports that the English were moving upon Ticonderoga in greatly increased numbers, and both Dodrill and the general conceived that a feint against Oswego would draw off the strength of the assailants, and, if promptly and secretly executed, might even be turned successfully into a real attack. Dodrill thereupon recalled Montcalm from Ticonderoga. Leaving the post in the keeping of Levi's and 3,000 men, he embarked on Lake Champlain, rode day and night, and reached Montreal on the 19th. Troops were arriving from Quebec, and Indians from the far west. A band of Menomonies from beyond Lake Michigan, naked, painted, plumed, greased, stamping, uttering sharp yelps, shaking feathered lances, brandishing tomahawks, danced the war dance before the governor, to the thumping of the Indian drum. Bougainville looked on astonished, and thought of the Pyrrhic dance of the Greeks. Montcalm and he left Montreal on the 21st, and reached Fort Frontenac in 8 days. Rigaud, brother of the governor, had gone thither some time before, and crossed with 700 Canadians to the south side of the lake, where Villiers was encamped at Niagara Bay, now Sackett's Harbor, with such of his detachment as war and disease had spared. Rigaud relieved him, and took command of the united bands. With their aid the engineer, Descombles, reconnoitred the English forts, and came back with the report that success was certain. It was but a confirmation of what had already been learned from deserters and prisoners, who declared that the main fort was but a loopholed wall held by 600 or 700 men, ill-fed, discontented, and mutinous. Others said that they had been driven to desert by the want of good food, and that within a year 1,200 men had died of disease at Oswego. The battalions of Lasser, Guienne, and Bern, with the colony regulars, a body of Canadians, and about 250 Indians, were destined for the enterprise. The whole force was a little above 3,000, abundantly supplied with artillery. Lasser and Guienne were already at Fort Frontenac. Bern was at Niagara, whence it arrived in a few days, much buffeted by the storms of Lake Ontario. In the 4th of August all was ready. Montcalm embarked at night with the 1st Division, crossed in darkness to Wolf Island, lay there hidden all day, and embarking again in the evening, joined Rigaud at Niagara Bay at 7 o'clock in the morning of the 6th. The 2nd Division followed, with provisions, hospital train, and 80 artillery boats, and in the 8th all were united at the bay. In the 9th Rigaud, covered by the universal forest, marched in advance to protect the landing of the troops. Montcalm followed with the 1st Division, and, coasting the shore in bateaux, landed at midnight of the 10th within half a league of the 1st English fort. 4 cannon were planted in battery upon the strand, and the men bivouacked by their bolts. So skillful were the assailants and so carelessly assailed that the English knew nothing of their danger, till in the morning, a reconnoitring canoe discovered the invaders. Two armed vessels soon came to cannonade them, but their light guns were no match for the heavy artillery of the French, and they were forced to keep the offing. Descombles, the engineer, went before dawn to reconnoiter the fort, with several other officers and a party of Indians. While he was thus employed, one of these savages, hungry for scalps, took him in the gloom for an Englishman, and shot him dead. Captain Bouchet, of the battalion of Bern, replaced him, and the attack was pushed vigorously. The Canadians and Indians, swarming through the forest, fired all day in the fort under cover of the trees. The 2nd Division came up with 22 more cannon, and at night the first parallel was marked out at 180 yards from the rampart. Stumps were grubbed up, fallen trunks shoved aside, and a trench dug, sheltered by fascines, gabions, and a strong abattis. Fort Ontario, counted as the best of the three forts at Oswego, stood in a high plateau at the east or right side of the river, where it entered the lake. It was in the shape of a star, and was formed of trunks of trees set upright in the ground, hewn flat on two sides, and closely fitted together, an excellent defense against musketry or swivels, but worthless against cannon. The garrison, 370 in all, were the remnant of Pepperell's regiment, joined to raw recruits lately sent up to fill the places of the sick and dead. They had 8 small cannon and a mortar, with which, in the next day, Friday, the 13th, they kept up a brisk fire till towards night, when, After growing more rapid for a time, it ceased, and the fort showed no sign of life. Not a cannon had yet opened in them from the trenches, but it was certain that with the French artillery once in action, their wooden rampart would be shivered to splinters. Hence it was that Colonel Mercer, commandant at Oswego, thinking it better to lose the fort than to lose both fort and garrison, signaled to them from across the river to abandon their position and join him on the other side. Boats were sent to bring them off, and they passed over unmolested, after spiking their cannon and firing off their ammunition or throwing it into the well. The fate of Oswego was now sealed. The principal work, called Old Oswego, or Fort Pepperell, stood at the mouth of the river in the west side, nearly opposite Fort Ontario, and less than 500 yards distant from it. The trading house, which formed the center of the place, was built of rough stone laid in clay, and the wall which enclosed it was of the same materials. Both would crumble in an instant at the touch of a 12-pound shot. Towards the west and south they had been protected by an outer line of earthworks, mounted with cannon, and forming an entrenched camp, while the side towards Fort Ontario was left wholly exposed, in the rash confidence that this work, standing on the opposite heights, would guard against attack from that quarter. In a hill, a fourth of a mile beyond Old Oswego, stood the unfinished stockade called New Oswego, Fort George, or, by reason of its worthlessness, Fort Rascal. It had served as a cattle pen before the French appeared, but was now occupied by 150 Jersey provincials. Old Oswego with its outwork was held by Shirley's regiment, chiefly invalids and raw recruits, to whom were now joined the garrison of Fort Ontario and a number of sailors, boatmen, and laborers. Montcalm lost no time. As soon as darkness set in he began a battery at the brink of the height in which stood the captured fort. His whole force toiled all night, digging, setting gabions, and dragging up cannon, some of which had been taken from Braddock. Before daybreak 20 heavy pieces had been brought to the spot, and 9 were already in position. The work had been so rapid that the English imagined their enemies to number 6,000 at least. The battery soon opened fire. Great and round shot swept the entrenchment and crashed through the rotten masonry. The English, says a French officer, were exposed to their shoe buckles. Their artillery was pointed the wrong way, in expectation of an attack, not from the east, but from the west. They now made a shelter of pork barrels, 3 high and 3 deep, planted cannon behind them, and returned the French fire with some effect. Early in the morning Montcalm had ordered Rigaud to cross the river with the Canadians and Indians. There was a ford 3/4 of a league above the forts, and here they passed over unopposed, the English not having discovered the movement. The only danger was from the river. Some of the men were forced to swim, others waded to the waist, others to the neck, but they all crossed safely, and presently showed themselves at the edge of the woods, yelling and firing their guns, too far for much execution, but not too far to discourage the garrison. The garrison were already disheartened. Colonel Mercer, the soul of the defense, had just been cut into by a cannon shot, while directing the gunners. Up to this time the defenders had behaved with spirit, but despair now seized them, increased by the screams and entreaties of the women, of whom there were more than 100 in the place. There was a council of officers, and then the white flag was raised. Bougainville went to propose terms of capitulation. The cries, threats, and hideous howling of our Canadians and Indians, says Doddrill, made them quickly decide. This, observes the Reverend Father Claude Godefroy Cockward, reminds me of the fall of Jericho before the shouts of the Israelites. The English surrendered prisoners of war, to the number, according to the governor, of 1,600, which included the sailors, laborers, and women. The Canadians and Indians broke through all restraint, and fell to plundering. There was an opening of rum barrels and a scene of drunkenness, in which some of the prisoners had their share, while others tried to escape in the confusion, and were tomahawked by the excited savages. Many more would have been butchered, but for the efforts of Montcalm, who by unstinted promises succeeded in appeasing his ferocious allies, whom he dared not offend. "It will cost the king," he says, 8 or 10,000 livres in presents. The loss in both sides is variously given. By the most trustworthy accounts, that of the English did not reach 50 killed, and that of the French was still less. In the forts and vessels were found above 100 pieces of artillery, most of them swivels and other light guns, with a large quantity of powder, shot, and shell. The victors burned the forts and the vessels in the stocks, destroyed such provisions and stores as they could not carry away, and made the place a desert. The priest Piquet, who had joined the expedition, planted amid the ruin a tall cross, graven with the words, "In hoc signo vincunt," and near it was set a pole bearing the arms of France, with the inscription, "Manibus dat livia plenis." Then the army decamped, loaded with prisoners and spoil, descended to Montreal, hung the captured flags in the churches, and sang Te Deum in honor of their triumph. It was the greatest that the French arms had yet achieved in America. The defeat of Braddock was an Indian victory. This last exploit was the result of bold enterprise and skillful tactics. With its laurels came its fruits. Faded Oswego had been laid in ashes, and the would-be assailants forced to a vain and hopeless defense. France had conquered the undisputed command of Lake Ontario, and her communications with the West were safe. A small garrison at Niagara and another at Frontenac would now hold those posts against any effort that the English could make this year, and the whole French force could concentrate at Ticonderoga, repel the threatened attack, and perhaps retort it by seizing Albany. If the English, in the other side, had lost a great material advantage, they had lost no less in honor. The news of the surrender was received with indignation in England and in the colonies. Yet the behavior of the garrison was not so discreditable as it seemed. The position was indefensible, and they could have held out at best but a few days more. They yielded too soon, but unless Webb had come to their aid, which was not to be expected, they must have yielded at last. The French had scarcely gone, when two English scouts, Thomas Harris and James Connor, came with a party of Indians to the scene of desolation. The ground was strewn with broken casks and bread sodden with rain. The remains of burnt bateaux and whaleboats were scattered along the shore. The great stone trading house in the old fort was a smoking ruin. Fort Rascal was still burning on the neighboring hill. Fort Ontario was a mass of ashes and charred logs, and by it stood two poles in which were written words which the visitors did not understand. They went back to Fort Johnson with their story, and Oswego reverted for a time to the bears, foxes, and wolves.